All good.
In the neighborhood.
All quiet on the Western Front?
On the, well, the Eastern Front, really. But yeah, it's quiet here. I'm sure it's quiet there too, because it's still pretty early. So it's Tuesday. It's November 1st. It's, God, the 1st of November this year.
Blown by.
Wow. What a year. What a year.
Yep.
Year-end review is going to be fun. It is the 1st of November. It is Tuesday. It is 9:30 in the a.m. on the East Coast. Bill is in New York. I am in Silver Spring, Maryland. And this is On Taking Pictures. This is episode 236. Is that where we're at?
Yeah, I do believe we are.
Can it can it really be 236?
Mm-hmm. You're nice and echoey in your room there.
I shouldn't be. I shouldn't be that echoey.
No, it sounded a little bit more than last week.
Why would it be more than last week?
I don't know. Did you have the, do you have the...
I'm in the same place.
Do you have the cushion up next to you like you did last week?
I didn't have one up last week.
Oh, okay. Okay. Forget it. Sounds great.
Wow.
Yeah. Did you finish your little intro? What else do we have to say? 136. 236.
236. It's a week from today. We get to decide whether this American experiment continues or whether, as Jim Morrison said, the whole shithouse goes up in flames.
Yeah. And from which perspective you view your comment right there depends on what side of the line you're on.
Right. You know, but I love, here's, I love.
Are you about to get political? I'm just saying you might want to give a trigger warning or something.
Okay.
Spoiler alert of some kind.
Well, here's what I don't like.
Okay.
That Senate Republicans have said in no uncertain terms that they're going to block any nomination. If Hillary Clinton were to win, that they're going to block any nomination to the bench.
Certain ones of them have, yes.
Yes, certain ones of them have, yeah.
And then so, some guy in the House says that they're going to start inquiries day one or whatever the hell.
Right. Yeah, sure. Richard...
Like, no attempt at actually, you know, doing your job and governing in any
right,
way.
Right, right. Yeah. And I'm not trying to... I think I would have the same criticism if there were... the Dems that came out publicly and said the same thing.
Sure.
That we are not going to do, I am not going to consider, I'm not going to do my job. I'm not going to do it. I don't understand that.
Yeah. Or what can be done about it? You know, it's like, how do you force these people to do it other than voting them out next time? In which case, you know, you still have got X years between then and, people love their congressperson, even though they hate Congress and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's awkward.
But I mean,
and it's,
just,
you know,
just publicly making this public declaration that I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do my job regardless.
Do you think that that is an attempt to sway the electorate so that they think, oh, well, if I were to vote for Clinton, she's not going to be able to do anything anyway because of those darn Republicans. So I might as well just vote for the Republican. You know, you think that's their angle?
Again, I would feel the same way on either side.
Sure. Of course.
If Mr. Trump gets elected and, you know, the Dems come out and say, well, you know, you blocked everything that Obama wanted to do. So we're going to block everything that you wanted. That gets us nowhere.
Yeah.
How
about people in government actually do their jobs that they're getting paid for and try to make the world better for people.
There's
in the
all of this, like, we're going to work beside the aisle, on both sides of the aisle, and it's all a load of crap.
Well, it's especially a load of crap recently. It used to be far more of a thing. I was listening to
Richard Burr, by the way, is his name.
Is that who
Senator
said it?
Richard Burr. Senator Richard Burr.
John Kerry was on.
Way to do your job, Dick.
David Axelrod, you know, from the Obama campaign, has a podcast where he has a bunch of really great people on there, though, and you know they speak intelligently about stuff.
Right.
And John Kerry was on a couple weeks ago, last week I think it was, and he's very well spoken. But he was talking about, you know, how when he was in the Senate in the 80s and the early 90s and stuff, that there was still this element of, oh, we used to go to dinner at each other's houses and hash this stuff out over a glass of wine. Like, work used to get done. And now, if you talk to somebody on the other side of the aisle in the elevator and somebody takes a picture of you two, suddenly it's on social media and both of you are getting, you know, primary challenges and that kind of stuff. So
I have a friend who has a theory about when it changed. And it was when...
Some people say when, Newt Gingrich.
Well, it was when Congress no longer had to live in D.C.
Oh, you think that's what it is?
Well, that's what she thinks. You no longer see these people. You no longer see them at the grocery store, at soccer games, at events, at restaurants. You are absentee colleagues.
Yeah, maybe.
And they cease to become other people, and now they're just ideologies that you have to rail against, whatever side you're on.
Well, maybe everyone should get on Facebook and we can have a Congress group. They can all chat online.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's give Facebook control over that. That's a good idea. Yeah. Let's give the company that lets you target ads to only white people. Let's give them the control.
Yeah. Well, you know, Facebook is there to make money, I guess. Anyway, yes, the next week is going to be very interesting. And yet, I really wish it was just over. Can we just fast forward to next Tuesday or Wednesday, rather? Just get it over with. How about we all vote today instead? Can we do that?
Anyway. If you're not going to do your job, then go find another job to do.
Yeah, get out of the way. Let somebody else in there who's going to do their job.
On either side. This is not a Dem or a Republican issue. It's just ridiculous. Anyway.
I think you and I should start a new political party called the Pragmatist Party.
The Pragmatist Party.
You know, just getting stuff done.
Getting stuff done. getting stuff done. Yeah. Well, we'll see.
So how you feeling today? You sound like you're in a state.
I'm okay. I'm okay. The last couple weeks, months, years,
decades.
You get to a point, or at least I sometimes get to a point, where I sometimes miss the arrogant prick I was in college.
Yeah, but you've told stories of how everyone around you didn't like the arrogant prick that you were.
Well,
in college.
Several people didn't like me, but that guy wasn't afraid to try new things.
Okay.
That guy wasn't afraid of failure. That guy wasn't afraid of what you thought of what he was making. Or not making.
Is that a element of youth, you think, or do you think that is is that lack of experience or is that testosterone or is that
I don't know. I mean, there are people who still believe that, who still believe that they do no wrong and will never apologize.
Eggleston says as much in the article we'll discuss later. Yeah.
But I don't miss the bad things, obviously. What I do miss is the confidence. What I do miss is the belief in my ability and where that ability could take me. That's what I miss.
Yeah, I used to have a similar sort of sensation in me that there was sort of limitless power if I just wanted to harness it the right way. You know, if I chose to do something, I'd do it well. So it really just became a matter of what I would choose to do. But I rarely ever have that sensation anymore. And when I get it, I try to hold on to it with both hands, 2 feet, and my mouth, you know?
Right.
Yeah, but I think that that's just an element of being a realist in a complex world.
Maybe, but it's the
what?
At least in the maker culture or in creativity, it's the dreamers that by and large get things done.
Sure, but for every dreamer that gets things done, there's a lot of dreamers who just
absolutely
dream. So.
Absolutely. And yeah. And I miss facets of that, you know. Without under Jobs, Apple gave us the iPhone. Without Jobs, we got a touch bar.
Right. Yeah.
And a little bit faster MacBook.
Yep.
It's like, well, okay, so what?
Right. Yeah. I tend to agree with you. You know, yesterday, I don't know how I got on it, but I got on a little Wikipedia tear about old people. I think I tweeted about this woman.
Were you not aware of them? So you had to wiki them to see what that actually meant?
Old people exist? No, they were talking. I saw an article about the current oldest woman on earth in Italy. I think she is. And she's like a 117 or something like that.
No, thank you.
Did you go to high school with her?
prom.
But they were talking about this. I looked up and I thought to myself, I can't remember who the oldest person ever was, you know, that they've been able to quantify. Mm-hmm. And it turned out it was this woman who lived to 123 years old. She was this French woman who died in 1997. And she remembered at age 13 selling colored pencils to Van Gogh because she lived in his town and worked at her uncle's store. So she was 13 years old and she talked to Vincent Van Gogh and she died while Clinton was president, you know? Mm. And I was just thinking about all the things that this woman saw. I mean, she saw electrification and cars and airplanes and nuclear weapons and World War I and II and the civil rights movement and computers and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it got me thinking. And then yesterday, after I did that, my buddy Claude came over and Claude and I went down to Greenwood Cemetery because he needed to shoot some pickup shots for a short movie he shot at a cemetery upstate, but he needed some other shots of cemetery stuff. So we went down to Greenwood to shoot and I'm staring there while he's walking around taking pictures. I was staring at the gravestones and I was staring at all these, the bodies of all these lives that were around me, you know, mm-hmm. And the dates that they lived and all this kind of stuff. And it kind of goes back a little bit to the political stuff you were talking about before. People talk, this is the most important election in history. It's like, yes, but they almost always say that. It may be that this time it's true, but everyone always says that this one is the one that's going to change everything, you know. And yet these people saw 30 years of these things over the course of their lives, and they still just live their lives, you know, that we worry so microly, but our lives are lived so macroly. And I wonder if sort of letting go of those reins a little bit and just letting stuff wash over you, as opposed to trying to hold on so tight or try to control everything and every movement. It's kind of like if you were riding a horse, you know, and the horse is like bopping you around all the time and you're holding onto the reins and you're trying to correct for every little thing. It's like the horse is doing the job. It's going down the road. You don't need to tell it to correct a quarter degree to the left every time you bop to the right, you know? And I don't know, just it got me into this holistic worldview that I'm trying to come to terms with, or at least expose myself to, so that when things feel crushing in the moment, I can just think, you know, nothing that's happening to me today, I will remember a year or two from now, other than a vague memory, most likely. You know, the things that are making me feel this way today, some client who's yelling at me for, you know, there isn't, but let's just say there is, you know, or, you know, some project I'm doing, or the fact that I feel crappy because I hurt my back yesterday or whatever it is. I mean, those things will just be something that happened to me years. Oh, I remember my back used to go out sometimes when I was younger or whatever. It's not going to be the thing that it is to me today. And maybe realizing that will free things up a little bit. I don't know. That's just my two cents.
Hmm.
Does that make any sense at all?
It does. It does make sense. But I think, you know, we are all where we are.
Yeah.
And yeah, in the grand scheme of things, because I can't figure out, you know, what to go take pictures of or how to paint a certain scene or, you know, how to write or whatever it is. Yes, those might be insignificant a year from now, but today they're crushing.
Oh,
today they're paralyzing.
Absolutely. But I guess my point is maybe there is no specific thing that you're supposed to take pictures of or write about. And that trying to find the right answer and failing to do that is just evidence that there is no such thing as a right answer.
I don't know that I'm searching for.
I'm not necessarily
a right answer.
I'm not trying to pick on you. I'm just saying as a general thought. Yeah.
I don't know that I'm searching for a right answer. I'm searching for
any answer that comes along.
I'm searching for something that feels like it gives me a sense of value and purpose.
Sure.
You know,
does peace enter into that or just value and purpose?
It depends on the day.
Okay.
You know, I mean, what we do, whether you take pictures or you know, write poetry or write fiction
or write code,
you know, code, do a podcast. Well, code, not so much code. And I'll explain in a minute.
Okay.
What we do or what we are trying to do is different than, and not better and not worse, just different than standing at a drill press 8 hours a day or riveting, you know, a part of a wing in an aircraft factory or what you're doing when you make is you're giving a piece of yourself. There are pieces of us in these things. There are pieces of how we see the world or memories or how we feel about another human being or right? It's not just a mechanical act. And as such, when those things are met with apathy, it hurts.
Sure.
It's personal. It's crushing.
Yep.
When the client doesn't like the work, when the print doesn't sell, when,
right.
you know, et cetera.
Yep.
It's different than, and again, not better or worse, just different than the hole got drilled a little off center.
Yeah. Do you think that it's, you just said that there's parts of you in those things. Do you think that it's actually that you're giving up part of you and putting it in there, or that it's a imprint of where you were at that moment? You know, is there loss in the creating in your mind?
I think there can be, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the project and whether that loss is simply reliving what inspired it or feeling like you've lost the emotional energy that you've put into it. Yeah, I think creativity, I think trying to put something out in the world that you feel is beautiful, relevant, important, thought-provoking, evocative. Yes, I do think that comes from the maker. I do think that not only the maker, but perhaps even the lives around the maker.
Okay. If what you made when you finished it still felt important to you and you felt like you did a good job, for lack of a better alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And it still gets, the response to it is still apathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you no longer feel like you did a good job on it?
I think that's a possibility, sure. But yeah. I mean, part of it, I think, depends on your circumstance in terms of,
sure,
if you are painting to make a living or shooting photographs to make a living and
sure,
nobody's buying your stuff, how can that not be a reflection on you? How can you not think that, you know, it's something that you're doing wrong?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm not a, you know, huge Chase Jarvis fan, like, you know, not a fanboy. Like, I think he's great, but like, I don't follow him all the time, right. But
I think he's a better businessman than he is a photographer. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's one of those people who like talks about making things more than he does making things a lot of times. And that's fine. It's whatever. It's fine. He's a good businessman. But he said something the other day that somebody put up about the fact that, you know, you're never going to turn your $500 client into a $5,000 client. That what you need to do is get rid of your $500 client and find a $5,000 client.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think about that in the sense
easy to say when you're surrounded by $5,000 clients. No, or more.
Sure. Yeah. But I think the crux of what I'm getting at is the fact that there are a lot of people in the world, and because the people who necessarily saw your work yesterday who were nonplussed by it, doesn't mean that that's how everyone responds. It's that's how the audience that happened to see it responded. And the same work may garner a completely different response from a different audience.
Sure.
I mean, there are times when I take almost the same pictures for $200 and $2,000 and $20,000, and everyone seems happy. And I'm like, wait a minute, there's orders of magnitude of payment here. I don't understand how, you see what I'm saying? Like, it's the same kind of thing. Like, you know, that it's, but I don't know. It's tricky and it's difficult and it's dangerous to allow the world too much power. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I am guilty of everything you're discussing, and I struggle with it daily myself. I'm just sort of saying what I would say to somebody else, not what I necessarily can say to myself. But it's what other people who know better than me say to me, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, and we get into seasons, myself included, where none of this bothers me.
Sure.
Where I'm just, you know, I've I've got my task and I'm just going about it. But then there are
the dark times, Bill.
Yeah. But you, can I say something after talking to you for 600 million hours?
Yeah.
I think you are arguably at your best when you are in this contemplative phase.
Hmm. Well, thank you. How do you mean? What do you mean?
I think that you are. It's stripped away in that gets you to a place where I feel like you're more accepting of new thought when you're in this place than other times, you know? And I think that that's a good thing.
It's Fight Club, right? It's Fight Club. It's, what's the quote? It's only when you've lost everything that you're free to accomplish anything.
Right. And Almost Famous, right? The only true currency we have in this bankrupt world is the things that we say to each other when we're uncool.
Right.
Yeah.
So I feel like lately anyway, that I spend a lot of time here without much to show for it. You know, I have my whiteboard filled with, I have two whiteboards, as a matter of fact, filled with ideas and project ideas and directions, and I look at them and I go, so what's any of, I get in these modes where I'm like, none of that means a damn thing. What am I doing?
Okay. What would mean a damn thing?
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm looking at things like if I, it's like Adrian and I were talking the other night, and I was like, you know what? I should just take everything off the board that's not going to make money. And she was like,
is making money your goal?
Well, not really. But she was like, well, what would be on the board then?
Yeah.
Nothing that's on any of these are guarantees.
No. No. I think that's ultimately that is the fault in your argument, right? And mm-hmm. I mean, how many times have we discussed and you've taken the opposite position and said it's the things you do for passion for you that cause the other things to come to you?
Yeah. But I'm in a spot where
you're doing the things that make you passionate and it's not coming to you. And then you kind of feel like, well, maybe this is the wrong way of going about it.
Right.
I have to make my living taking pictures, and I will tell you that it sucks over here too, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm with you. But again, it's the journey, right? The journey that we always talk about, and the doing the work that we always talk about, isn't always a pleasant or happy or satisfying task.
Mm-hmm.
If it was, it wouldn't be so hard to be on the road doing the work,
right?
You know, I'm sure every time Stephen King sits down every morning and starts typing, there are lots of days where he gets a half a page done. Or types and throws it out, or like in The West Wing where Toby's writing and then starts lighting it on fire because, you know.
And there have been a couple of those days lately where I just go, none of this is any good. None of this means anything. None of this, it doesn't mean anything to anybody else. So
yeah, but isn't that exactly where you want to be? Because you are realizing what is and what is not good. You could argue that if you felt like what you were doing right now was really great all the time, then that you almost want to be sitting somewhere greatness is rare, right?
Yeah.
Excellence is rare.
Yeah, sure.
And so sometimes I feel like being bad a lot of the time is actually you being aware of the fact that your standards have risen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're on the next switchback of the plateau. And that's not a bad thing. In fact, if anything, it tells you you're going up.
Maybe.
I don't know. You and I are an interesting thing. I used to, I had an ex-girlfriend years ago.
Wait, are you saying I remind you of your ex-girlfriend?
No, you have nicer legs than she did. No, you don't have nicer legs than she did. But she and I were very much in we were both on our on alternate sort of sine wave cycles, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm up, I'm down, she's up, she's down, and they were on slightly different wavelengths. The frequencies are slightly different, so that there were times when we were both up, there were times when we were both down, and vice versa.
Sure.
And I think that you and I have a similar kind of dynamic, right? Where it's sometimes we're talking to each other on the high end of our things. Sometimes we're talking to each other on the low end, and sometimes we're talking past each other in the middle.
Right.
And I think if you listen to the podcast for long enough, you can almost hear where we are in those cycles going up and down.
Yeah, you can hear that rhythm.
Right. And I think today you and I are both, you know, maybe I'm up and you're down, but we're at least sitting on the same, you know, same line.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a good thing, right? I mean, that's where progress gets made. I don't think that you should see it as anything more or less than that. I mean, you got your Japanese saw.
I do have my Japanese saw.
Is it all that in a bag of chips?
It's pretty cool. Yeah. It's an interesting motion because you're cutting on the downstroke, on the pullback.
Yeah.
And
which seems like it's much more controlled than going the other direction.
It's much more controlled, and you're letting the saw do the work. You're letting the tool do the job that it's supposed to do, rather than
right.
You know, pushing into the wood.
Can it cut really hardwoods, or is it sort of meant for pines and that kind of stuff?
No, it can do hardwood.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and it's Man, it ripped through a 2x6. I did a couple cuts and it ripped through a 2x4 and a 2x6 in, you know, just a couple minutes. And it's a clean cut.
Which is pretty impressive because I had a miter box and a miter saw and had to, like a hand, you know, saw.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I had to cut through some 2x4s when I built the walls for my corner a couple of years ago because I didn't have a circular saw or anything here.
Right.
And man, it took a long time. 2x4s are way harder than they look.
No, this, it just, it ripped through them. And you know, I took my speed square and just did a line. And you do a couple light strokes just to set the corner. And away it goes. And it just, man.
If you let go of the handle, does it keep going like a Magic Disney thing? The Magic Disney saw?
Yeah. Yeah, this is all interesting. I'll have to think more about this.
Yeah, I, you know,
I mean, it just, I, you know, you, Yeah.
Go ahead. You
know.
What?
Well, part of it's the book. I've been working on this book for a long time.
Right.
And the publisher decided to pass on it.
Okay. So you're you're gonna have to find somebody else.
Well, the thing that is throwing me for a loop is they love it. They love it. They love the look and feel of it. They love, you know, they love it. And they took it to their quarterly meeting with different booksellers, you know, with Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and you know, museum bookstores and all that. And they all loved it.
Okay.
They just don't know what to do with it. They don't know who the audience is. They don't know how to market it. But so this is what's, and I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, well then, where does that leave me?
So maybe the comment isn't on the book. It's on the marketing.
You know, maybe. I mean, I'm still, right, you know, all I'm doing, I know this is not going to be, you know, I'm not going to retire to, you know, Ibiza from this book
and have a room just for your shoes.
That's right. All I'm trying to do is make something that I wanted to see. I'm trying to make something that I look at and I go, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Well, up until the final moment of having a stack of 100 of them in a box next to your desk, you've done that. No?
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah, okay, pretty much. So, I mean, I'm about 90%+ done. Right.
You get my point though.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not like you had an idea for a thing and you sent an outline to somebody and they said no, and you're like, well, I never get to do this thing. You've done the thing.
Right.
Well, the old thing? You can't control how people react to your art.
Right. But now I'm wrestling with the thing and going, well, do I let this... and I know the answer to this, but it's still a wrestle of, do I let this beat me and just go, okay, whatever, fine, and, you know, go quietly into the night, or do I go, you know, screw you guys?
Yeah.
You know, I appreciate the feedback. I appreciate, and look, no, they were great.
Right.
They were terrific, very supportive. They provided me with all sorts of insight and, you know, feedback from not only themselves internally, but from this meeting. And I
changes
not
that you
grateful.
Actually made or any changes that they suggested.
Expanding one of the areas was their only note, really.
Expanding. But, they wanted bigger.
Yeah. They wanted one of the areas, they wanted more content there, which I said, okay, great. I love that. I think it's good. And I think, if anything, you know, now I'm kind of back to my whiteboard going, okay, well, what does this mean? And oddly enough, the book itself may be a byproduct of getting me somewhere else.
Right.
You know, the book may be part of this overall sort of little ecosystem that's poised to come out of it.
Sure.
But I was in a funk about it. And to a lesser or greater degree, depending on the day, I still am. Because it's, again, it's we love it, we love it, we love it, we love it. We don't want to do it.
Right. Yeah. 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 And that, I mean, that happens all the time, man.
Yeah.
You know, look, you know, famously, one of my favorite books, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, was turned down by 121 publishers before it was chosen.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so,
well, I mean, so I got 120 to go because I've it's only been the one.
You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. It's, you know, look, it's, you know, your book is not trying to be the great American novel, so it's a slightly different thing.
No, I think what will happen, or what could happen now, is it may come out as an ebook first.
Okay.
And then
by you or by or
to be determined.
Okay.
I don't know. And then maybe do a Kickstarter for the printed version, and I may do a small print run at first, and then maybe another run later on.
Yeah, or do a small print run of even, I don't know, 40 books that you'll number and sign or whatever it is that you could sell for a little more that'll help pay for a larger run.
I just want to see the thing. I just want to see it on a shelf somewhere. Well, I don't want it to be electrons bouncing around. I want to see. I want to smell it.
Yeah.
I, you know.
Yeah, but you know what? If doing, even having that conversation today versus 20, 30 years ago, if you really want, you could have that on your shelf next week, you know?
Yeah, if I wanted one, I could have one.
Yeah, yeah. Or 100 or 1,000 or 100,000. I mean, the point is that that barrier, the barrier of, yes, it's nice going to a publisher and having a publisher and having a go to bookstores and what, yes, all that stuff is nice, but it's certainly not a requirement for having physical books in hand like it was before.
And I think we have enough people who are interested in the subject matter that would enjoy a copy of it in one form or another.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't beat yourself up over it. It's just a matter of time.
Come on, man. I beat myself up over everything. You know that.
That's true.
It's what I do.
Good point. The can I swerve a little bit?
Are we sliding?
Can we? Or do you want to keep going?
Speaking of sliding, a quick aside.
Yeah.
My oldest friend Mark and I were driving to Tower Records one day in
Hollywood?
No, wasn't Hollywood, actually.
There was one in Hollywood, right?
There on Sunset.
Yep.
It was raining, and we were getting off the freeway, and the car started hydroplaning. He was driving. It was in his Mustang GT, and just we did a complete 360 on the off ramp, and he was as calm as a Hindu cow, man. And he was just like, "Ah, the old sliding."
during the slide?
During the slide. And I'm watching the world go around 360 degrees. And then without missing a beat, he just kept going. He never even stopped. It was just 360 degrees and kept going. And it was like, who does this? Anyway.
You know, it's funny. I years ago, when I was at University of Connecticut for a couple of years, my cousin David and I, he drove an old Land Rover, like the ones with the like from 1970s, you know, sort of like the big Jeep kind of ones.
Yeah, sure. Like the ones you see on Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. So he owned one of those, and we were driving from stores down to where we lived. He lived in Watertown. I lived in Southbury. And it was December. I think it was coming back for Christmas break kind of thing. And we were on the highway. We're on 84. We go through Hartford, and there's this turn in West Hartford where the road turns like 30 degrees really quickly. And we were driving. It was snowing. It was slick, but like traffic was moving. And we come around the corner. We're in the left lane. We come around the corner, and traffic is just dead stopped. And we're going 60 miles an hour on a slick road in a car with, you know, not the best brakes in the world.
Right.
And David, who's a good driver and now a cop, but like, you know, it's one of those situations where you can't do anything, starts hitting the brakes, and the car just catches a slide like on the ice. And we go across three lanes of traffic and stop just at the barrier, at the Jersey barrier on the right, and just kind of come to a stop. And there was no one in the way. Like, just, it was like one of those freak moments where there was exactly the room for the car. Nice. Like we were playing Frogger or something.
Right.
The road. And I remember we stopped, and I was like, holy, you know, when your adrenaline gets going, I'm sure during this spin, your adrenaline was,
oh, I was firing, I was away like, oh, what's going on? What's going on? He was just, you know, couldn't be bothered.
Although, you know, we were last week in Vegas. It was raining when we got into Vegas, which is really odd, like raining pretty hard. People in Vegas cannot drive in the rain. Like they have,
nor can people in California.
Yeah. Or it's like people in probably where you live, watching them drive in the snow. You know what I mean? Like famously people in Virginia can't drive in the snow, or, you know, DC shuts down everything when there's an eighth of an inch of snow on the ground or whatever. It's just really funny how people, you learn how to drive where it is you drive and you can't drive anywhere else, you know? Somebody sent this in. Who sent this in? Because I want to give them good credit, because it's a good article. Peter did. Peter Geyser. Geyser. Did we ever figure out whether it's Geyser or Geyser?
I think it's Geyser.
Okay. Peter Geyser sent in the New York.
One thing
yep,
real quick.
Yep. Yep.
Peter Geyser, are you going to be at the Albert Watson talk? If so, hit me up.
Oh, where's Albert Watson giving a talk?
He's going to be at the National Portrait Gallery.
Oh, okay.
In DC. Tickets are free. It's November 10th, I think.
I like to the National Albert Portrait Watson. Gallery.
Yeah.
He's pretty great.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, so he sent in this New York Times Style magazine, which is the magazine that goes in the Sunday paper, I think once a month.
Sunday paper.
Thanks, Joe. You like Joe Jackson?
I love Joe Jackson.
Yeah, those records especially look sharp, and it's like they're just flawless.
Supremely talented.
They're on the level of the Elvis Costello stuff of the period. You know, that stuff's way ahead of its time.
Agreed.
So William Eggleston, the pioneer of color photography, and it's not that long, but it's this little article. A writer named, let me get the name right. Oop. My browser just lock up. Oh yeah, that's weird. Augustine Burroughs.
Augustine Burroughs. I love this article. I got to tell you. Go ahead. But I got to.
All right, no, go.
My favorite part of this article. After this whole long story of him, and it's terrific. He's sitting with him. He's drinking with him. He's listening to stories.
Yep.
And the final paragraph of the piece. Are you a genius? I ask him. His fingers instantly leave the piano keys, suspended in midair above them, and he swivels toward me with an expression of bald incredulity, as if I've asked, do you use toilet paper? His eyes are grayish blue until just before the pupil, where the color becomes something close to honey, and they are fixed on my own. He replies in a breathy, almost pitying drawl. Well, yes. The unspoken message is clear. You've spent all day with me, and you even have to ask?
See, I
love that.
There are many William Eggleston photos that I am enamored with. Like, I really like his work.
Yep, he's up there for me.
But I've watched, did you watch the Eggleston, the movie? You know what I'm talking about? The documentary about him?
Yes.
Where he's just basically drunk and smoking and whatever the whole time, just sort of like seems kind of miserable. And it's fascinating to me hearing him there and hearing him talk about the stuff where he says, oh, you know, I don't care what people think. I just made it. And, oh, do you like talk about photography? Well, talking about photography seems to be a waste of time. You know, like there's, you know, if you look at the damn, they're meant to be looked at, not talked about, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then they cut down two thirds of the way in the article. They go back to his apartment, and this sign that's inside of his apartment. What do you think about that whole thing? The whole the alcohol thing.
Well, it's kind of ironic.
Yeah. For those of you who haven't read it, there's a sign inside his house that says the occupant of this apartment was recently hospitalized for complications due to alcohol. He is on medically prescribed daily portion of alcohol. If you bring additional alcohol into this apartment, you are placing him in mortal danger. Your entry and exit into this apartment is being recorded. You will be prosecuted should this notice be ignored. The Eggleston family. So obviously the man is a serious alcoholic, right?
Right.
Seems to have been for decades, right?
further down.
Yep. He's sitting there drinking bourbon or whatever.
Well, Burroughs asked him if drinking ever got in the way of the photography. And he said, I've never been able to take a picture after a drink. It doesn't work.
Right. So ultimately, it's kind of sad. You know, it's like almost like a sad, pathetic portrait of a man. That's how I've always felt about him. Like, yeah, he's this genius, but he's also this tragically flawed character that I would never want to be myself, you know? So I find it interesting.
Well, I don't think you could be this character.
Right.
if for no other reason, for Eggleston, photography seems to be a compulsion.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not an expression, though it is that. It's not artistic, though it is that.
Yep.
At the root, it's a compulsion.
Right. But a compulsion for a man for whom it doesn't need to be a money-making proposition necessarily. He's famously comes from a fairly well-off family.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also this sense of he's sort of a rich kid playboy who gets to throw his whims around, whether it's drinking or photography, you know?
I think that's an oversimplification. I think he's very aware of what he's doing and his contribution to photography. And I think he's aware of it despite...
Should an artist be aware of their contribution to the larger art? You know, should they be thinking at that level? See what I'm saying?
I do. I don't.
Or is
know
that,
that
in
I have
itself
an opinion
a is that in itself a strange, almost not narcissistic, well, narcissistic kind of way of looking at it? You know. I mean, look, he's a 77-year-old man. Who,
I mean, okay. Should they be aware? I mean, what? How is being aware of it any different than your pursuit of it? You pursue greatness. You've said this.
Yeah, sure. But even if I accomplished it, whether I did or did not accomplish it, Paul McCartney changed popular music. Yet I don't know that Paul McCartney would necessarily say, you know, I changed popular music, where I feel like William Eggleston might. See what I'm saying?
I do.
I don't know that it's necessarily good
or
bad.
I don't think it was a goal. Based on what little I've read, watched, or listened to,
I don't think
that was the goal. And being aware of it is different to me than that being the site.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
I don't know that Eggleston ever set out to create an iconic color photograph, but create iconic color photographs he has.
He did.
Multiple times over.
Yep.
So,
although the stuff that you and I and everyone else sort of squee upon is largely much older work than the newer stuff, which is always interesting to me. The photographers, the artists for whom they're very well known for a particular period of their work, and then they're sort of forever attached to that. You know, the sort of same thing with, say, Nan Golden, right? Everyone always talks about the, I forget what the exact term of the thing is, the abuse one. Which I mm-hmm. don't even remember the name of, you know, or whoever, right? That it's William Eggleston's guide encompasses probably 70% of what people know of William Eggleston's work outside of serious fans of his, you know.
Sure, but I think at least for me, some of his later work is more compelling than somebody say like Stephen Shore.
Okay. Yeah.
Again, for me.
Yeah. Were you and I talking about Shore's Instagram feed? We talked about that on the show.
We talked a little bit about it.
Yeah,
I
thought that this article was really interesting. I think that it's interesting. There was a section in here, where he's talking about the fact that he's answering the questions, but he doesn't really seem like he's there answering the question. Like he's being polite answering the questions, But that he says, he politely answers every one of my questions, sometimes prefaced with a weary, I've been asked that before. I have the feeling that I could ask him what his credit card number is, and he would tell me if he knew it. It's not that he's easygoing, but rather somehow abstract, as if he exists on a plane elsewhere and visits occasionally when pressed. Love that. When I show him Kim Kardashian's Instagram feed, he says, I don't know who that is. I've never even heard that name. I mean, is she famous like me? As if anybody outside the world of photography knows who William Eccleston is. You know, it's an interesting way that he sees himself in the world, you know?
Yeah. It's like it's kind of refreshing.
It is refreshing in the sense that it's almost like he has a very local view of himself. Does that make sense? Like, I don't mean local as in Memphis, Tennessee, but a local as in he knows his place in his segment of the world, which is this photo art world, right? And he's secure in that and he's fine in that. And he doesn't then have to feel the need to compare himself with every other person in every other field out of the 8 billion people out there, which is the modern world of social media and the internet and all the rest of it, right? He's sort of isolated from that giant rat's nest of noise. And that is, I find that refreshing.
I think he's always thinking. I mean, and you get a glimpse of that.
Whereabouts?
In, he's looking through, where is it? As I look through hundreds of his pictures, parenthetically, you're going too fast, he scolds. I wonder about the images Eggleston doesn't take. If he'll shoot a freezer stocked with frozen entrees, why not the refrigerator below? So I ask about the times when he thinks of taking an image, perhaps even raises the camera to his eye, but then changes his mind. What I want to know is what makes him decide not to shoot something. And this is the telling part here.
Yep.
And I, you know, I have to take him at his word on this. Yep. Eggleston.
Sure.
That doesn't happen, he says with firm authority. When he raises the camera to his eye, it's because he's going to take a picture and the picture is going to work. The end. He either takes one photograph of his subjects or no photograph of it. There's never a moment of internal consideration or indecision. There is only certainty, which explains why he has no favorites. Quote, each one to me is equal, or I don't take it to begin with, end quote.
Sure, but somebody is making curatorial decisions because we don't see all of his images.
I don't think he can be bothered with it.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe that's why he has his son do it or whatever.
I've created nuclear fission. You figure out what to do with it.
Sure, but you have to remember the man is also quite drunk probably while saying all these things.
Well.
No?
But he's not drunk when he's taking the picture, so I don't know that excuses it.
No, I know. I don't know. He does seem like, he seems like the kind of person who couldn't exist today. Does that make sense?
But he does.
No, I mean, yeah, but he's a holdover from another time, right? He's a 77-year-old man. So what I mean is that he doesn't seem like the kind of person who could be 20 or 30 today, you know? He's a Southern gentleman who wears suits and bow ties and walks around taking the pictures he wants to take and to hell with the world, kind of, you know? It's all very... I never imagined William Eggleston with other people. I always imagine him sitting alone or talking to himself alone or walking around with a camera alone, you know, even though, I mean,
and maybe that's just fine.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But it's just, it's like, he feels like a literary character, not a real person to me.
It's something out of a Tennessee Williams play.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. You know,
I'll tell anyway, you what, I do want that book. He's got a new book called The Democratic Forest.
Yeah, well, we should get a copy. Is it on sale yet?
No, comes out November 22nd.
Well,
So, you know, if anybody's looking for a Christmas gift for me, that'd be good.
The Democratic Forest, Selective Works.
Yeah.
Hardcover, $44 on Amazon. I will put a link in the show notes. Yeah, it's good stuff. It's a very good article, though. I mean, it's a relatively short interview altogether, but pretty strong as those things go. A lot of times you watch those things, you're listening to those things and you're like, okay, you know.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that article much more than I enjoyed Philip Seymour Hoffman talking about Capote.
You didn't like that?
It's okay. He seems strung out. He probably was.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting is that he, it's funny. I watched a number of different interviews with him as of late.
He seemed like he kind of didn't want to be there.
Well, he never seems like he wants to talk about himself, and I think that's what it is. I don't think he likes talking about himself.
You know, then why sign up for these things? Because they're not going to want to talk about other things. They're going to want to talk about you.
I didn't take it that way. I took it as he's a man uncomfortable talking about his own work because he feels self-conscious about it. But I watched other interviews with him, and that's actually him at his best. There were a few where he was definitely strung out because he was sort of almost slurring his speech and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And those were very sad to me.
I think that I don't think that
he necessarily cares what people think of his work. I guess they're both addicts in their own way, right? Him and Eggleston kind of come at it from a similar point of view in some ways. They're both trying to react to the world in their way, and maybe that way is drinking or heroin or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
What got your attention on this? The other day we were over our friend's house watching their 3-year-old daughter, because they were having a baby at the hospital. So we were over their house watching their daughter. And we put Holly to sleep, and we were sitting watching HBO, and we watched an episode of Westworld, and that was fine, but I couldn't watch more than one at a time. It's just a little too intense. So I was like,
let's come back to that, because I've started watching it.
Okay. Capote was on, they have HBO now, and I was like, I wanted to see the scene in Capote where they bring the fictional Dick Avedon in there to take pictures of the guys, because he actually shoots with a Hasselblad, and they actually have the sounds right on the Hasselblad. And I remember that, and I was like, I want to see that again now that I'm more of a photo nerd.
What do you mean they have
the
sounds right? You think they go in and ADR the sound of the Hasselblad?
I think that they probably did, because it's very clearly done. Either that or they were miking it in the right way. The point is that they did it right. You know, they actually did the photo right, which so often you're watching and it's somebody with a Leica and it sounds like an SLR, and you're like, okay, well, that's not the way that camera sounds. Whatever, it's nerd minutia. But it got me sucked into the movie again, and we watched the rest of it, and his performance is just really great in that movie. And talk about somebody who is a flawed character. Jesus, you know, Capote himself was a nut job who demanded that the world love him, and to hell with everything else. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to do whatever I can to become known and famous and all the rest of it. Like, that seemed to be his goal, you know? Anyway, that got me thinking about Philip Seymour Hoffman, and that got me watching this 92nd Street Y thing, which I just thought it was interesting, him talking about his craft and talking about, you know, the moderator asked him if when he's in character like that, if he stays in character, you know, famously like Daniel Day-Lewis and all the rest of those guys. And he's like, look, you know, it's not about an ego thing for people who do that. It's really about, it just takes a little time to get sucked into the physicality of it again, you know, to like get in that place again to do it, so that people who do it, there are some maybe who are doing it for some larger ego reason, but some of them are just doing it because it takes so much time that going and eating lunch as you and then coming back and trying to be him again when they say action is really hard to do. So it's easier just kind of just stay in that place for a little while and eat lunch and then come back and do the thing. There was something it's the word of the day, pragmatic about the way he discussed acting in his craft. Like, it was like, oh, I do this for these reasons, you know? And even when he was talking about, there's a scene where, it's towards the end of it. He was asked about the fact that he was nominated for an Oscar, and it was before the Oscars, I guess, this thing. And it was the year that, Heath Ledger got nominated for Brokeback Mountain. And he says, you know, you seem to be a shoo-in for this thing. And then they nominated Heath Ledger too. And everyone keeps talking about this Brokeback Mountain thing. You know, do you have any thoughts about that? He's like, look, I can't wait to see it. He said, you know, I got into this because I love great acting. So if that guy acts his heart out, essentially, if that guy's as good as they say, I'd be happy that he wins. And I'm happy to see it because I'm here for the larger goal of great work, you know? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I just liked that answer and the way that he went about it. Anyway, I thought it was interesting for anybody who's a Philip Seymour Hoffman fan. Might be worth watching. I'll put a link in the show notes.
His character choices really changed as his career went on.
Yeah. Is there one specific one, a turn that you're thinking about?
Well, think about, the first thing I ever saw him in was, Twister.
Yeah. Actually, right? He also was in, Scent of a Woman as the annoying kid at the end. I don't recall. I wasn't wearing my glasses. Where's like up on stage. Anyway.
He goes from playing Dusty to the next thing that I saw him in was probably Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Who was
not an unsimilar character.
Yeah. Similar to Dusty in many ways. But then, I don't know what would have been next. Maybe Lebowski, maybe?
Yeah, that's I'm looking here. Twister, Boogie Nights, Big Lebowski.
But I don't think I ever took him seriously until Talented Mr. Ripley, because he just seemed like this goofy character actor. Like he was going to be relegated to the sidekick role.
And right? Magnolia.
Oh yeah, sure.
As the nurse, yeah.
Yeah.
And I really like him in State of Maine too. I guess there's those 99, 2000 is really when he started. And then my favorite role of his is actually in Almost Famous.
Yeah.
I just like him in that. But I like that.
But
movie.
It just, I don't know. It just got really
serious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that there's a lot of actors for whom, a lot of artists period, for whom they'd love to be doing Truman Capote and, Doubt, but can't mm-hmm. get those roles until they take whatever roles they can get at the beginning, which maybe is the guy in Twister, he was also terrifying as the bad guy in Mission Impossible 3. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill your wife. I'm going to kill that whole thing.
Right. That
I'm
going to
hurt you like yeah. that. All yeah. that stuff. It's yeah. like, oh man, he's not the guy you want to mess with.
What was the one he played? The guy that, that had the gambling problem. Do you remember that?
I don't know that I know that one. Savages?
No.
He's in Punch Drunk Love too.
Man, what was it?
I don't know.
I'll have to look it up, but he played
he's pretty cute in Pirate Radio too. Did you ever see that movie?
Yeah, that was pretty fun.
Yeah, it's cute. He's good.
I'll have to look it up.
Charlie Wilson's War. He was just a great actor. It's, we haven't said it in a while, Jeffrey, but heroin, it's never a good idea.
Never a good idea.
It's sad because he was really kind of firing on all cylinders the last few years, and it's, whatever. What are you going to do? It's very, very sad.
Owning Mahoney. That's what it was.
Owning Mahoney. I never saw that one.
Yeah. Bank manager with a gambling problem, access to a multimillion-dollar account, gets you into a messy situation.
Good film?
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, it was good.
All right. I'll add it to...
he was good in it.
All right. That's fair. Yeah. Anyway, so if you're into that kind of stuff, go listen to that interview. I found it revealing and good. Oh, man. It's one of those mornings, isn't it?
It is one of those mornings.
Let's talk about our sponsor, Squarespace, and then we'll get on to the stuff I know you really want to argue about, which is the Apple stuff.
Oh, I don't think there's an argument there.
Are we both? Go ahead.
I dig Squarespace. You know what I've been digging lately?
What?
And I haven't launched any of them yet, but these cover pages.
Yeah, they're pretty cool.
I'm starting to do more voiceover work. So I'm doing like a little page for some voiceovers.
Sure.
I'm doing a little cover page for the book just as kind of a teaser.
Sure. Yeah.
They're so cool because they exist within the site, but they can look wholly unique from the site.
Yeah. Yeah. I use a cover page for when I'm working on my site and I want to kind of put it into maintenance mode.
Oh, okay.
I have a cover page that I can turn on as the homepage and then it has no navigation on it.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
It's a cute little thing. You know, it still has my contact info and some pictures, but it's not anything.
That's a terrific idea, actually.
See, this is it's about hacking. See, now,
in WordPress, you needed to use a plugin.
There is a weird maintenance mode plugin in WordPress, isn't there?
There are a few. Yeah.
Yeah, you think that would be built in by now? But anyway. On Taking Pictures is brought to you by Squarespace, which provides the tools that help people turn their passions into a business, like Jeffrey. Wait, you're turning your passion into a business.
It's no longer Build It Beautiful?
They have all kinds of taglines.
Can you no longer make it beautiful?
Sure. I'm sure you can still make it beautiful. In fact, I think it's already beautiful. From internationally recognized brands to your favorite local shop, Squarespace is trusted by hundreds of thousands of savvy shop owners around the world, like you, Jeffrey.
Am I savvy?
Well, you. I don't know. Are you?
I don't feel savvy.
Their sites, of course, look professionally designed. I was on somebody's site the other day. Does Patrick use Squarespace for his site?
I don't remember.
I think he does, and I think I was looking at it the other day. Sites look professionally designed, regardless of your skill level. Like if you're Jeffrey, they can look super great. If they're me, they can look super mediocre, and if you're really terrible, they can look amazing. No coding required. They're intuitive, easy to use tools like drag and drop stuff. You got an image, you drop an image box, you drag an image into the box. It creates 27 different versions in the background, so it looks great on every device. Retina images, so the things look good on the new Retina MacBook Pro with Touch Bar.
The last standalone display Apple will ever make.
Yeah. They don't actually make it. Get a free domain.
No, the previous, not the
other. Oh, okay. Yeah. Get a free domain if you sign up for a year, which is fantastic. So sign up for a year and you save your $15-$20 that you would normally have to do to buy googlybear.com. I met a guy at the airport the other day who has awesomefarts.com. He pointed that out to us when we started talking about the internet and domains, like stupid domains that you own. I was like, I don't own anything nearly that terrible. Yeah, it's pretty awful. Awesomefarts.com. So start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code OTP and you'll get 10% off your first purchase, and you will show your support for our show, these On Taking Pictures programs.
Hey, you know what I wish?
What?
Here's what I wish when we're talking about Squarespace. I wish that there was a common feature pool.
Yes,
templates pulled from.
I agree. That is one criticism I would have of Squarespace is that sometimes you're in some other template and you're like, oh my god, this would be amazing if it had the same I don't know gallery full page thing as this
icons,
one or whatever.
Yep. Blog features.
I agree. Yeah, but I think they're
make one master list and then you could let the user turn features on and off as needed.
My guess is that Squarespace 8 will put something like that in there. They got pretty good designers.
Yep.
It would be really hard to do this in a way that you could throw different chunks in and still have it look good. You know what I mean? That's impressive.
Yeah. If you were going to do a redesign of everything, I would imagine it would be a little difficult.
Yeah.
But it just makes the new templates stand out so much more
than
the previous ones.
I'm with you. A lot of the new templates, though, were for like restaurants and magazine-y kind of things, and I think they should come up with a new portfolio or two to throw into the mix. But overall, man, Squarespace has got it where it counts. It's like the Millennium Falcon, but with like a brand new Millennium Falcon. Did they ever show any other? What kind of freighter was the Millennium Falcon?
Corellian.
Do they ever show any other Corellian freighters?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if they all looked exactly like that or if it was, you know, different.
Maybe they do. I mean, maybe I'm sure there's some Star Wars fan out there that could point
that out.
I'm sure
there's drawn 33,000 of them. All right, so let's talk about this new Apple thing. Apple released a new MacBook Pro, which was desperately needed with Skylake processors. The 15 inches have 16 gigs of RAM standard, but you can only ever get 16 gigs of RAM. The SSDs are built onto the motherboard, so you can't upgrade anything at all in any of these machines.
Apparently, so says the rumor mill.
That the 13-inch SSD is removable, right?
Not something what like I was going to say, but yes, that's true. That next year, the RAM will be 32 gigs.
Where'd you hear that?
It's up on Mac Rumors. Ming Chi Kuo. Yeah.
Yeah, that guy's an analyst. Yeah, that's what he says.
Yeah, but he's been pretty accurate.
All right. I mean, look, Phil Schiller said that 32 gigs of RAM would use too much battery power. And I'm like, okay. I really don't think, RAM uses some battery power. Exactly. Just make them 2 millimeters thicker and put in more battery and give me 32 gigs of RAM.
I am so over Apple's obsession with thin.
Yeah. Although, man, the new ones are thinner than the MacBook Air 13-inch, which I own one of, which I don't understand how it could possibly be thinner than that. But
I understand how. I don't understand why. Again, you're making a portable device. Yeah. Put more battery in.
Yep. Yep. Although these things do get like 10 hours of battery, supposedly. So, it's not the end of the world.
And good job removing MagSafe, something that every laptop owner has ever experienced.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a good feature.
A feature that benefits every laptop.
Yeah.
Good idea taking that out.
Although I will say that the idea that we just now have four of the same exact ports that can do pretty much anything, whether it's displays or networking.
So come
or
up
USB
with a MagSafe USB-C port. So come up with a MagSafe Thunderbolt 3 port.
Yeah. Or I'm sure Griffin makes a little thing that plugs into USB-C that connects on the other side and has a magnet connection in between.
Yeah, but again, should adapters and dongles really be a product category?
No. But theoretically, I mean, look, how many people use Ethernet on their laptop still? Probably not that many. How many people, I think that they should throw at least one adapter in the box that's USB-C to type A. You know what I mean? Because a lot of people
or the adapter that lets you plug your new phone into your new laptop and charge it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you got to go pay $30 for that one too.
No SD card slot. Yep. Hello?
Yeah. Somebody said, what are all these people complaining about the SD card slot? Real photographers plug their camera into their computer via USB. It's like, well, first of all, no.
Yeah, sit down.
No. And secondly, you still need an adapter for that because it's going to be USB type A, certainly.
I just don't understand it.
All right, so.
No more light up logo either.
Yeah, I saw that too. I don't like that. I always like the light up logo. Look, you and I are old timers. I understand a lot of these things that we're complaining about.
It's not a matter of old time. Does this make the machine better and more useful?
Yeah. It's a nice bit of tech, right? You got to admit that it's a beautiful piece of whatever.
For the 13-inch with the touch bar, it should be.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So my question is, what do you think of the touch bar? By the way, I'm going to put a little video in. There's a CNET article with a video in here of the section where Adobe came up and showed how what stuff will pop up in Photoshop on the touch bar.
I think it's a terrific idea in theory. I'm curious to see how it will be used. I loved the for those of you who edit video and are Final Cut Pro users, I would imagine these features will come to Premiere Pro if that's what you use or DaVinci Resolve, if that's what you use. But to be able to kind of scrub through with your finger, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's neat.
Adobe's whole thing about you can, make brushes bigger or smaller.
Yeah, it's keyboard commands for idiots.
Right. I mean, okay. Or you could hold down Control and Option and drag the mouse around.
Exactly.
There's a thought. I think they made a bigger deal about it than it is. I think this is a great feature. I don't think this should have been the hinge pin feature of the new laptop.
I agree. And I don't personally know how incredibly useful it will be, especially as somebody said the other day, I think it was on the Accidental Tech podcast. I think Marco or somebody said, until these features are available on all the Macs, if they're just on the MacBook Pro and you can't get a desktop iMac with this, but you get it on the laptop. That's crazy. Even though a desktop keyboard with this thing would need bigger batteries and blah, 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 and would be way more expensive because it's essentially an Apple Watch built into the blah, 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 blah.
Well, let me ask you something. You do know more people that this might be applicable to, but I want to ask you. In the demo, they showed the what I'm assuming was the 15-inch Pro as the centerpiece to a dual 5K editing setup with a 20 terabyte array.
Yeah.
if you've got all that, are you going to be using...
And by all that, you mean $10,000.
Yeah. Are you going to be using a laptop as the brains of it all?
Yeah, personally, no. I mean, I, if this was the only computer available, could I use it? Sure, I could. Would I rather have a more powerful CPU and more RAM? And yes, absolutely.
I guess the
I'm a desktop guy though. I don't what do I know?
It just, you've got this beautiful edit suite.
Yep.
And at the centerpiece of it is a laptop?
Yeah. Yeah. Which it doesn't make any sense to me. And then at the same time having the computer that should be the center of that, which would be the MacBook Pro or the Mac Pro rather, be languishing for over 3 years without a single update on their supposed, holy grail Halo product, Mac. A slight twist. Do you think that there's all these articles out lately that say Apple doesn't care about the Mac anymore, so don't bother getting upset about it because they're just kind of they're phoning it in anyway.
The Mac feels like it's gone from, and maybe not based on specs, maybe based on the way it's marketed, but it feels like it's gone from powerful piece of kit to a lifestyle product.
Yes. Yeah. Even this touch bar for people who are keyboard command people, people who are serious Photoshop users are using all their keyboard commands anyway to do 90% of what they were saying is so powerful about this thing. It's like context aware keyboard commands. That's neat. Sure. But it's not going to change the world of somebody who's a serious Photoshop user, So you got to wonder, at the same time, removing some features, at least, the connectivity and all that kind of stuff, or arguably, the limitation on the RAM and blah, 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 that real quote unquote pro users would actually want,
And I don't want to make this a back when Steve was alive,
yep.
But it does feel like Apple has become a marketing committee driven company rather than serving a vision.
Yep, I agree. But that's what we expected, right? I mean, there's still, look, is this a nice laptop? Yes. Is this the nicest laptop out there? Maybe it's up there. It's a really nice laptop. Is it
still not great video?
The video cards are terrible. The top of the line one is essentially a RX 460, which is a $100 GPU that you could buy at Newegg right now for a desktop machine. $100 GPU is what you have as your top of the line in your laptop.
$3,600 laptop.
That is, if it was like a 480 in there or a four, something like that next step up, I would be like, all right. But yeah, no. Especially for something, it is entirely unupgradable across the board. Not that GPUs were ever really upgradable in laptops. But yeah, but that new LG monitor is nice, except the 5K one really only works with this computer right now.
Apple has said that they are no longer making standalone displays.
Yep. Well, I guess the thing, and I always have a mixed reaction here. It bothers me that Apple seems to be making decisions based upon profit motive alone. I realize that that's the point of a business. I understand that. But I feel like, to your point, they used to have more of a vision of where they wanted the world to be, profit motive or not.
Seemed to be.
And I feel like they're just like, well, yeah, we can make a great display that does all these things better than an aftermarket one. But there's not much profit in it, so let's not. And that might be the sort of downside of Tim Cook being an operations guy and not a guy who thinks more loftily, Mm-hmm. And to a point, people keep discussing, the keyboard on the new laptop and how, it's got the Touch ID in the upper right-hand corner. Right. So therefore, the upper left-hand edge of the strip is also entirely black because they wanted the symmetry of the fact that things didn't go all the way to the left, but not all the way to the right.
Right.
It's like such a Johnny Ive thing, And it's like, oh my God, Johnny Ive, stop. Not everything needs to be perfectly symmetrical and square and whatever all the time. Sometimes it's better that it's not.
But Bill.
Yeah.
It
It does. It's the most beautiful. Okay.
Yes, it does, Bill.
Little twist. Have you seen the Microsoft Surface thing?
The big giant thing. It's pretty cool looking.
Yeah. Problem is it runs Windows.
I know.
And I wonder if it, all the cool little tricks, like whatever that guy is using, or the gal, I didn't notice who's actually holding the pen in that video.
Oh, with the little puck on the surface?
Yeah, with the puck. The puck's pretty cool. If you were a person who is like, oh, I got to choose a color, it's like, beep, you know, rotate it, done, keep going. That's a pretty cool new little interface thing. You just put it wherever you want and it figures out where it is and whatever.
As long as it doesn't scratch the surface.
Right. Fair enough. But I wonder if what it is that person is drawing in. Is that just like Microsoft Paint, or is that something, you know, will you be able to do similar stuff in CC 2017 when it comes out soon, apparently? That'll be interesting
probably.
To see.
It'll probably be an Adobe thing or an Affinity Photo.
Looks
thing.
Pretty cool, but it's expensive. It's like $3,500 or something for one that you really want. So. Yeah. I mean, it's more expensive than an iMac would be, a 5K iMac, which is also a really nice machine. Anyway,
yeah,
I
configured one, and I think it ended up being
iMac or, you know, which one?
One of these Surface Studios.
Oh, you did. Okay.
And they top out at about $4,500.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
There was an article the other day about computers, the overall state of in a, air quotes, good computers being relegated to high-end consumers now.
Yeah, like normal people aren't willing to spend the money on a good computer, so they've stopped trying to sell a good $1,200 computer. So it's either $699 or $2,699.
Right. Which, I mean, you know, economically, I've heard a number of people say there's no money in the middle.
Sure.
You either go low-end or high-end.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, but it is interesting, Microsoft being the people coming out with something that we all go, ooh, that's cool.
Right.
You know, I mean, they have before. The Surface Pro little laptop-y tablet things got fairly good reviews for creative
stuff.
But
if you look at this, if you just saw this thing without branding on it, and then saw a little Apple logo on the back, would you go, oh, yeah, that makes sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, and
I mean,
I think
the keyboard is almost a direct ripoff. The mouse is almost a direct ripoff.
And I think that's what's a little sad about it, right? That hey, look, if Microsoft can come out and grab the mantle of the creative pros that Apple doesn't seem to want to cater to, then excuse me.
Wow.
Let them do it, you know?
Could you make a note of that, please?
Yeah, I got it. You know, then the hell with it. Let them take those, you know, sure. If you make Windows that good and make your hardware that good, I just want to get work done. I want a good tool that gets work done. And right now that's Mac OS on, for me, a Hackintosh. That's fine. If you can make a better thing, great. The better thing for me is not a 15-inch laptop that costs $3,000 with what I need in it.
Well, that's just it. You could get this thing, this Surface Studio.
Yeah.
The entry-level one is around the same price.
Yes, yeah. I'd love to see the performance. I'd love to see how it feels. I'd love to see, you know, when they come out, I'll go to the Microsoft store and play with one, you know, and see what it's like. I mean, I'm not in the market for anything right now, but
it's interesting that there are only three configurations. There's 3,000, 3,500, and I think the top one is 4,200.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yep.
Those are your choices.
Yep. Yeah. What is that thing called? It's just the
Surface Studio is what it's
Studio.
Called.
Studio.
Yeah. I'll chime in. Podcast at ontakingpictures.com. What do you guys think? Is this kind of hardware attractive to you? Is it important to you?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to a small subset of people. You know, my friend Gideon Kendall, who's this monster illustrator, for him, this could be amazing. He works on a Cintiq now, but the Cintiq resolution isn't great, and it's kind of sits up the glass above the actual thing. I mean, this thing for him, a 28-inch 4,000 by 3,000 display that he can work like that, like a drafting table. That's
right.
That's exactly what he needs. You know,
right.
He doesn't give a crap about the platform. Yeah.
I wonder, is it Gorilla Glass over these things? Do you know?
I'm sure they're pretty strong. Anyway, look, I like the fact that Microsoft is making cool stuff because I like cool stuff.
Yeah.
All right. What else?
We're running a little long.
Yep. Let's talk about the group.
So, barring any of the hashtags or assignments, you guys are putting up some really, really terrific pictures.
Yeah.
Really terrific pictures. And I thank you for that. It's inspiring to look at. It's inspiring to see how you guys see what's around you.
I like Hugh's picture of the woman stacking chairs.
Hugh has been, he's kind of a new user to Instagram, but he's been putting up some killer stuff. We had lunch with them, with Hugh and his wife, at this little Greek place in Manassas over the weekend.
Did you go out to the battlefield?
Nope. We met them for lunch and, what's it? Katarina's is the name of the place. Really sure. Terrific.
I like that battlefield.
Vijoy, ritual in front of a 400-year-old Shiva temple engulfed in the roots of a banyan tree. That is...
Bum, bum, bum.
I mean, it just looks magical, doesn't it?
It's pretty cool.
It just looks like another world.
The top one by Tim... where it's like the little girl in the Halloween is all smoky looking. That one's pretty good too.
Yeah.
That feels like what's her name? Cameron.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Photo from like the 1890s or something. It could be
Julia Margaret Cameron.
There you go. Thank you.
Robert Barone framed in the car window, probably a standard wedding photo back in the 50s.
That is awesome. Look at that.
Yeah. These are my parents leaving our parish church in the Bronx.
Yeah.
What a terrific picture.
18.
Yeah.
With that mustache.
Yeah. What a terrific picture, Robert. Thanks for sharing that. Connors, you guys really missed a great time at the grounds for sculpture yesterday.
Yes, we did.
What else? David Lawrence. That's a little creepy. I love that.
Do you see Johann Troyer's picture up on the mountain?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, thank you. Beautiful stuff.
Yeah, really terrific stuff. Mike Gates, sunrise from behind our local shopping mall. Are you kidding me? What shopping mall is on the banks of this? That's nuts. So there, if I turn around, there's a Chipotle? I mean, come on.
Chipotle. That's what I think I'm having for lunch today.
There you go.
So what do you have for this week? You got something good?
I'm just looking at so the Albert Watson thing is in the group if you want to go.
I'll find is it the portrait gallery?
Yep. Same place we saw Dan Winters.
Yep. When is that?
It is November 10th, I think. Okay. November 9th, my mistake.
Okay. So it's next All right. week.
What else? Chris, you know what? Is it Lepe? What would you think that is? L-E-P-E. That's a crit wall image. We'll talk about it, but it reminds me of a Coke ad from the 70s. So, spoiler, I love it.
Anything that involves Jeffrey and the 70s.
It's true. It's true. It is true. The 70s was kind of... Yeah, that's the place. So, this week... Since we're running a little late, out of the ordinary.
Out of the ordinary. I like it.
What do you think of that?
I think it's good.
Out of the ordinary. So, go see what you can find. This scene doesn't look like the other.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. By the way, it's technically at the American Art Museum.
The other wing. Yeah, the other wing.
The other side. That's the one thing about that place. It's like it tries to be two things at once. And it's, I mean, I know it's two halves, but sometimes it's confusing where you are and what you're looking at and which museum you're in.
Yes, it is.
Anyway.
Okay, so this week's photographer of the week comes to us from OTP listener Jim Azevedo. Thank you, Jim.
Yay, Jim.
Shin Noguchi. The website is okay. It's not great, I will
tell
you.
His Instagram feed's better.
Yeah, the Instagram feed is better. But I really dig this stuff. It's terrific work.
Sometimes a little Eggleston-esque.
Sometimes, yeah, like the Japanese Eggleston.
Yeah, yeah, like the car in the parking lot, and some of the just shots of the floor or the front of the Cadillac there.
Mm-hmm.
Picture of the TV with Judge Wapner on it. Wapner.
Uh oh, Wapner.
Wapner. I hardly know her.
Oh, jeez. We got to get you some new material.
I already told you that joke last week.
you could probably say that every week.
I know. I'm such a simple man.
That's right. So Shin Noguchi, let's run down the about.
Loves the color.
Yeah. Award-winning photographer based in Kamakura and Tokyo, Japan. He describes his street photography as an attempt to capture extraordinary moments of excitement, beauty, and humanism among the flow of everyday life, and has a discreet, poetic, and enigmatic approach that is sensitive to the subtleties and complexities of Japanese culture without using posed, staged, and no finder hip shot.
I'm sorry.
That's a long sentence.
Wow. That's one sentence?
That's one sentence.
Oh, that's awesome.
But I'm sorry. It's two sentences.
Good for him.
Quote, street photography always projects the truth. The truth that I talk about isn't necessarily that I can see, but they also exist in society, in street, in people's life, and I always try to capture this reality beyond my own values and viewpoint or perspective.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I dig this stuff.
This is good. Yeah. This is very good. The good kind of street photography that I'm never good at, but I enjoy other people's versions of.
I would love to talk next week.
Sure.
About, we talked about it. We kind of skirted around it last week about elevating work.
Ah, yeah, sure.
And I wonder if we could go down the list to the best of our ability anyway, and talk about what separates good street photography from great street photography, and maybe give examples, and then go maybe the next week. What separates good landscape from great landscape? Good portraiture from great portraiture.
We could make it a instead of obviously taking a whole hour to discuss each one of those. We could make it like
no,
a little
just
segment.
Make it apart. And kind of tackle different genres for the next 5 or 6 weeks or something.
Sure. Yeah, that could be fun. I'll put a link. Put a note in the show notes. You got anything else to say about Shin?
Nope. I just
do we know how old this guy is?
I don't know. I don't know.
Let's see. Anyway, we'll have to figure that out.
Yeah. Interestingly, a lot of his pictures not super sharp.
Yeah.
Because not really the point.
Yeah. For that, it's not the point. Oh, I've been to Kamakura because they have the big giant, the giant Buddha there. That's a cool place. Very pretty out by the water. If you want to get a hold of us, 347-687-9411, you can call and leave us a voicemail. We'll listen to it. If you would like to get a hold of us, podcast at ontakingpictures.com or at Bill Wadman, at Jeffrey Sidoris on the Instagram and Twitters. Anything else you want to say?
There is an article on his site that he compares an iPhone 7 and a Leica M9, a side-by-side comparison.
Okay. Pretty funny.
You might get a kick out of that.
I will take a look. That in the blog section?
Yeah, it's in the blog. Yeah.
Okay. I will take a look on the blog for just such an article.
Yeah. If you've got, if you've got ideas for discussions, something you want us to banter around,
yeah,
you can leave that too. Podcast it on Taking Pictures.
Yep. We like ideas.
And maybe this month we should do another Q&A show. What do you think?
Sure. Yep. Yeah.
Maybe end of the month, year end, or a year end Q&A show.
So. Well, that will definitely do.
Yeah.
Cool. Jeffrey, I will talk to you next week.
Yep. Have a terrific week, everyone. Thank you for listening. We appreciate it.
Going on and on the way we are. For so long, to any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. As this way, say what you wanna say.